Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. One of the pleasures of my life in recent months has been reading the 5 novels by my guest, Edward St. Aubyn. They are books about one family, the Patrick Melrose novels, the Melrose family. The most recent of the books is published in hardcover by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, but at an incredibly generous bargain. The first 4 books, Nevermind, Bad News, Some Hope, and Mother's Milk, have been published by Picador as a paperback original, all 4 of them in one book. Now, since it's some of the very best comic writing being done today, I wanted to ask you, who are your idols in the world of the comic novel?
I suppose the novelists I've admired aren't all comic, but I was very interested in Joyce and in Beckett and in Proust. But there are lots of funny bits in Proust. But I suppose novelists that are predominantly comic, Evelyn Waugh, but. Much less than those others I've mentioned. Henry Green, I think, is brilliant, and of course Nabokov, writers whose comedy comes out of the effervescence of their style as much as the situations that they describe.
I'm very interested because, you know, I recently got to see some of Dickens's notebooks, and he crosses out and rewrites constantly. And I thought, in the heat of that composition, that he didn't. These books give the feeling of having been written very freshly, but one suspects, in fact, that they're the last of many, many drafts. Because the depth of the book is tragic, the downfall of a culture, a family, an individual, and the intimation that it's very hard to keep an identity solid enough to go through life with, that identity is the result of pain, not the result of accomplishment. But on the other hand, the ongoing surfaces of the novels are dazzling. They feel like Noel Coward plays or Woodhouse novels. They're incredibly pleasurable to read. They're hard to finish because when you finish, the darkness gnaws at you and you feel, you know, frightened by the undertow of the books.
Yes, I think, although if you do finish all 5 as they stand, I think the end of At Last is genuinely redemptive and does take you away from that that tension that you're describing, which I think is absolutely true. I think they're basically tragic novels with an often hilarious surface. And I don't, I think I just see life like that. I see it as being alternating between heartbreak and hilarity, between the ridiculous and the unbearable. I don't think I can really kind of negotiate that. It's not a formal decision on my part, you know, to write a tragicomic novel. It's something that arises from quite deep in my temperament. And as we know, the same event can be tragic or comic depending on the distance from which it's viewed, although some events are non-negotiable.
Well, it's interesting because it seems as if from generation to generation in these books, indignation is one of the strongest of emotions, and one of the words that comes up is a word used to express indignation, that word flagrant. You know, this is flagrant arrogance, or, you know, it's often the impulse of these characters to be outraged by the circumstance they're in, whatever it is.
Yes, I think that covers a whole range of concerns within the novel. One is that kind of exaggerated language used by frivolous people, in which it's a nightmare that they couldn't find a parking space or whatever. There's that. But also, it's the more darkly than that, it's the feeling that characters like David Melrose have, that they can be as outrageous as they like, that they're not subject to the judgments of ordinary morality. That's where it darkens and becomes dangerous. That's where the outrageous really is outrageous.
Now, we're put here without any manual or guidebook, although several of the characters rattle about what they call their spiritual toolboxes. But the characters seem to learn, if they're in really soul-shattering states, that whether they want to or not, there are certain places they have to turn for solutions. So one of the characters, Johnny, seems to have become a fairly serious psychoanalyst, believing in the possibility of finding a way out of the labyrinth. And although there are foolish New Age philosophers in the book, it seems like in these books, philosophy, particularly philosophy of consciousness, might be another way out.
Yes, Johnny is a character who we first see as
a fellow addict.
A fellow addict of Patrick's, exactly. We meet him in Bad News. And then he starts going to group therapy sessions in order to become abstinent. And then he becomes more and more fascinated by psychotherapy and eventually is a psychoanalyst in the last book. So that's certainly one route. And as a result, Johnny's reading the world in terms of self-knowledge, you know, the absence or presence of self-knowledge. So in the last book, at last, there's an arena of points of view on the dead person at the funeral, which is the setting of the novel, Eleanor Melrose, Patrick's mother. And you know, some people, particularly benefactors of her delinquent philanthropic generosity, think she's a saint. You know, some think people, you know, Patrick thinks she's a bad mother. Mary, Patrick's estranged wife, thinks she's a bad mother, but from the point of view of another mother rather than as her child, and so forth. But Johnny sees her as someone drastically lacking in self-knowledge. So I think, yes, Johnny certainly establishes that. And then Annette surprises us, because Annette appears to be a sort of goofy, a New Age nitwit, but in fact turns out to be the person who's most spontaneously kind and who keeps doing the right thing without reflecting on it very much. And so she shifts during the course of the novel, and Patrick appreciates that. And ends up being rather moved by her, when he was terribly embarrassed by her to begin with, to think that his mother had fallen in with such people, you know. But then he sees her for what she is, which is a person who is trying to be good, and that's not a disreputable project.
Well, we first met her, Annette, in Mother's Milk, where she's moved into the house that would have been Patrick's inheritance. The guru of the institute has moved his lover, we learn it's Annette, into the house while Patrick's family is staying there for their 2-month break. They're allowed to summer there before the house is taken away. So it's a real surprise to find him seeing Annette with anything approaching graciousness.
Exactly, and she's not a nothing is allowed to remain completely simple. You know that Annette is not a villain. You know she's someone who's a beneficiary of Eleanor's lack of self-knowledge, but who is in herself someone trying to be good. So it's more complex. And, you know, I don't know that the novel is... that all these novels are recommending anything, but there are certainly people who are thinking constantly about the problem of how to be free and how to be good. There's Annette, and there's also... as we've mentioned, Johnny, but there's also Erasmus, who's a much more formal philosopher, Erasmus Price, who's thinking about the problem of consciousness in a fairly concentrated way during his interior scenes in At Last, and so solving the riddle of consciousness and identity is another route that's being explored. But Patrick comes to his own conclusion at the end of the novel about what might set him free, and it's not quite any of those other things, but it's certainly contributed to by all of them.
Now, the first book is called Nevermind, and I thought that it was a kind of pun. There's a philosopher in that book, too, who seems to think that mind is not going to be the solution to one's difficulty in the world. In fact, I said, never mind. And I thought that that was, in its way, a direction for the novel, that these characters need, through various ways, addiction, sadism, to be stripped of the rational mind and come to something much less available to people, a respect for silence, a recognition that although silence may be a Buddhist solution, that Buddhist solutions frequently are unavailable in Western society, that what is it that Patrick is moving toward?
He's moving... I don't want to paraphrase the end of what is now actually 22 years of work, because I did start Nevermind in October 1988, and as you say, it's got multiple meanings, as all the titles of these books do, but he's certainly trying to move beyond consolation. We've seen people who are trapped in the search for consolation and trapped in a game of substitution, of substituting one consolatory object for another. And so he certainly has an intuition that renunciation is an important part of what's going to set him free. But then it goes a little more deeply into it than that. But I agree that's not, to go back to your earlier point, yes, that's not, as it were, an intellectual solution. It's not a result of working it out in that sense. You're right, there's that very elusive part of the meaning of never mind, yes.
I'm talking to Edward St. Aubyn about particularly At Last, the final novel of the Patrick Melrose novels. Those began with Nevermind, went on to Bad News, Some Hope, Mother's Milk, and now At Last, which I myself suspect is not the last we'll hear of the Patrick Melrose novels, at least I hope not. Now, consolation. The consolation of heroin, the consolation of sex, the consolation of alcohol, the consolation of flattery, the consolation of family love. He seeks something pretty austere and next to impossible, to be without the need for consolation, What is that? Do you know?
That's a state that he comes to at the end of At Last. It's quite different from being inconsolable. It's, in fact, being unconsoled is almost the opposite of being inconsolable. Because if you're unconsoled, you've given up the need to be consoled, you know. Whereas if you're inconsolable, you go on thinking that you could be. And so I think it's to do with seeing things exactly as they are. You know, he's concerned with how it is, not how it might be or how it might have been or how it could be improved or changed, or but just seeing things exactly as they are, a kind of ground zero of reality. And he knows that he can only reach that through abandoning the search for consolation.
Now, his son, the younger son, Thomas, says something toward the end of At Last. After the funeral, his mother's funeral, Patrick says that, no, he probably won't come home for dinner. And his wife, Mary, who's, you know, the other kind, a martyr to people, for people who need consolation. She says, well, call us if you change your mind. And Thomas says, that's what minds are for. And on the last page of the book, Patrick will be calling because, you know, he's following a child's advice. And one of the fascinating things about the response to this book, these books from Mother's Milk on have been rapturously praised, but the critics seem to say that this agreement to change his mind is sentimental. And I think that what's happened is the books have turned the critics into harsh parents because, for goodness sake, all he's doing is making a phone call. He's not saying, I'm going to live with you forever, or I'm going to stay after dinner, or we're going to be able to be a family again. He's saying, I'm going to come have dinner. I'm afraid to be alone in my hotel room again. I don't want to witness the parade of voices. But it seemed interesting to me that books like this would make critics into stern parents in a peculiar way.
I don't know that very many of them have been turned into stern parents. I think I've had a very easy ride. But I do, and I don't read my reviews in general, so that may be an illusion. But I do know that that one critic who was otherwise very generous said that. But I think that's missing the point. The point is clearly the double meaning of changing your mind. And so by changing his mind in this trivial and symbolic way, he's signaling that he's determined to really transform his attitude to life, and which is a much more serious project, and there's nothing sentimental about it.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Edward St. Aubyn about his Patrick Melrose novels. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Edward St. Aubyn about the Patrick Melrose novels, novels that follow a single character as he moves from the terror of his family and its society and his culture. And I want to continue by talking about these novels as a recognition of the breakdown in a certain kind of society. Is the society changing around Patrick by the end of the book?
I think that certainly the values represented by Nicholas Pratt, who comes in at the beginning of At Last and is the representative of Patrick's father on Earth. Patrick's father died, luckily, a few volumes earlier. But those values of snobbery, hardcore genealogical snobbery, you know, contempt, and entitlement and so forth. Those values are perishing. I don't think it's a sociological tract in any way. I don't think I'm saying something about the state of Britain. I think I'm concerned with snobbery as a human attitude, you know, as the desire to discount people in advance. And what's snobbery made up of? It's various attitudes, isn't it? You want to find a reason not to empathize with people because it's difficult to stop thinking about yourself and empathize with someone else. So why not dismiss a whole section of humanity in advance? That's a very useful function of snobbery. Also, the idea that you can acquire power by association. Well, it's much easier if you could just become powerful by sitting next to someone powerful. It's much easier than having to do something yourself. So again, the attractions of snobbery are very clear, you know. But they're also universal. The obsession with status, with comparison, with toxic comparison, constant comparison with other people. These are deep human impulses, and they have a particular flowering in English society. And the flowering they have in sort of Nevermind, which is set in 1965, and that they have towards the end, in At Last, which is set 40 years later, is different. And I think it's true that England has become much more interested in, like, you know, in celebrity than in, you know, aristocracy and things like that. I mean, it's changed the object of desire a little bit, but the processes remain the same.
It's fascinating to read in Bad News. Patrick goes out into the streets and attempts in a peculiar way, it's such an odd scene, to talk like a tough to street drug salesmen. And they kind of fall for it. Everyone likes the aristocracy at this point in the world. And he goes upstairs and witnesses an entirely horrific scene from a different kind of novel altogether, a working-class novel, an underclass novel, as a drug seller and his girlfriend, wife, it seems, are really trying to make their next month's rent off Patrick, and eventually he's going to see that drug dealer in an orchestra, you know, wearing a tuxedo. You know, a whole change. We realize that nothing stays stable, that nothing is as you think it was when you're viewing it from the point of view of addiction and constant consolation seeking.
That's right. I think, although you're absolutely right that there is a central protagonist and that these novels do follow his story from early childhood to middle age, you're right to point out that there's quite a large cast of characters as well. Chilly Willy, who you're talking about, and Patrick, the drug dealer in New York, and Annette and Seamus. You know, it's not just this tight world of privileged English people by any means. There's a big cast of characters. And I think that you're also right that I'm obsessed in these novels with shifting points of view. And that is the great virtue and strength and flexibility of a novel, is to discover the dramatic truth of a situation by surrounding it with different points of view. And I think what happens in terms of narrative is that the narrator gradually disappears, and by the time you get to At Last, you just have the mentality of one character after another telling the story without anyone telling you what to think about the character. They're just sort of presenting the story, and I think that took me a long time to learn, you know, that I eliminate some of the machinery which is there in Nevermind. You know, it's a narrator telling you what to think about the character, thinking about the situation, whereas the one layer gets swept away, I think, maybe by the end. I hope so, anyway.
Well, I think that for me, I felt that it was very important to the author and to Patrick to give us a sort of, well, goodbye to all that, and a never again. That whatever is going to happen in either society or the novel, no one is going to be able to perpetrate these authority figures anymore who destroy us in such lasting ways for so long.
I agree that at core this the books are about cruelty and the misuse of power and people searching for the freedom to escape the consequences of that. And we won't see that kind of misuse of power again, the particular kind that we've seen now. But, of course, power is constantly misused. It's almost, you know, what it's there for. It's in its nature to become misused. So we must be vigilant.
I've been talking with Edward St. Aubyn. He is the author of the Patrick Melrose novels, four of them in one volume from Picador, the most recent called At Last, in hardcover from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Edward, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
It's been a pleasure. I highly recommend these books. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from the Patrick Melrose novels at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craiger Thine. Connie Alvarez is my co-producer. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Moshe Kasher is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.